Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us on this 29th day of November. We are thrilled to have you all here. Everybody is in their place, ready to go, and we couldn't be more excited to introduce them all to you. Let's welcome, for the second time this week, we couldn't be more thrilled to feel like we won the lottery, Vice President of Editorial Development for the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick, is with us. Good morning, Judy.
Woohoo! Glad to be here.
Good to have you back. Thank you very much. Our dear friend Fran Berman is here, the Edward Hamilton Distinguished Professor of Computer Science at RPI and a faculty associate at the Bergman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Fran, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Geeks on the radio.
It's good. We love it. And Siena College Professor of Comparative Politics, Vera Akarios-Kelly joins us. Good morning, Vera.
Good morning.
Wonderful to have you back. Thank you very much for
being
here.
Yeah, it's good to be back.
And WAMC's Alan Shartok. Good morning, sir. How are you? Excellent. Very good. Doing his best, Eeyore. That's good. Good, good, good. If you would like to join us, all you have to do is go to WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and you could write to us. We would love to hear from you. Let us go and start with what is happening in the news. And I'd like to actually start with Yemen. Rebuking Trump senators back effort to suspend U.S. support for Saudi-led war in Yemen. This from the Washington Post. The Senate on Wednesday delivered a historic rebuke of Saudi Arabia and President Trump's handling of the fallout over journalist Jamal Khashoggi's killing last month as a decisive majority voted to advance a measure to end U.S. military support for the Saudi-led war in Yemen. 63-37 vote is only an initial procedural step, but it nonetheless represents an unprecedented challenge to the security relationship between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. The vote was prompted by lawmakers' growing frustration with Trump for defending Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and his denials of culpability in Khashoggi's death, despite the CIA's finding that he almost certainly ordered the killing. I will look to you, Vera, of our Yemen expert.
So it's a really interesting development, of course. We're expecting something of a pushback. However, we'll see how far this actually goes. I think it's a very interesting question that's emerging now. Not only is it the larger question about human rights and how much the United States has supported Saudi Arabia, but the larger question is both Saudi Arabia and Iran are horrible regimes. Torture people, mistreat women, execute people publicly. They're deeply repressive regimes. Now, we have chosen in the United States to always be on the side of the Saudis, at least since the Islamic Republic's revolution in 1979. The question we have now is it really a partnership? Still a strategic partnership to be on Iran, on Saudi Arabia's side, since what we do is prop up a repressive regime that is never ready to actually carry out any kind of direct confrontation with Iran, but relies on the United States to carry out all of those war efforts. We have sponsored the Saudis, we've given them weapons, we've provided them with fighter jets that they then use to bomb Yemeni populations. It is the Saudis that encourage us to bomb Iran. It is the Saudis that perceive certain strategic advantages from engaging the United States in regional wars. I don't think it is to our advantage to bomb populations. I don't think it is to our advantage to support a deeply repressive regime. I think this entire strategic alliance might come apart at the seams, especially now that the House will become democratically controlled. This is the first warning shot that maybe our larger regional policy will come apart. And now there's this interesting question. Why was Gina Haspel, CIA director, not involved in briefing members of the Senate?
So that was going to be my second question. that obviously is the big... I didn't get into it in the article. But what could possibly be that rationale?
I mean, she listened to the tape, the taping of the, you know, the sounds of Khashoggi being murdered. She has a lot of detailed information. There's absolutely no doubt that the Crown Prince ordered this murder.
Now, to our knowledge, is she the only high-level official who has admitted to listening
yes.
to it? The president said he wasn't going to listen
no.
to it. Bolton has said he's not going to listen
yes.
to it. Okay.
Well, it's I guess if you want to keep the argument alive that it's unclear and there isn't a smoking gun and you can't really know for sure whether the Crown Prince ordered this murder or not, I guess that it's best for you not to listen to the tape. But, you know, despite all of the other sort of the other circumstances should indicate very strongly that he ordered this assassination because he's done it before. Many times, and he's just a ruthless dictator. So why are we surprised, and why do we say we need better evidence that he has ordered this killing?
So Vera, so here's a question. So Mattis and Pompeo are making the case that Saudi Arabia is a strategic partner, a national security partner, mm-hmm. a business partner, all of that. And there are, you know, if that's true, which it's what I'd like to know is how true is that? What are the short-term, medium-term, and long-term implications of, you know, giving them this precedence over what we see as a human rights issue,
mm-hmm.
You know, in order to retain that? What do you think?
So, I mean, long-standing interests, of course, are weapon sales. I mean, that's what's predominantly of interest. Ever since World War II, the United States has relied on Saudi oil in exchange for the Saudis buying weapons. That mm-hmm. that was the deal, right? The strategic alliance.
Mm-hmm.
The United States is now the largest producer of oil in the world, of mm-hmm. oil products. It doesn't need Saudi Arabia like it once used to. The weapon sales issue, in some ways, it's an interesting arrangement. Yes, the Saudis pay for the weapons, but we often have to fly the planes for them.
Yeah.
Our military carries out their wars, in essence.
Uh-huh.
Of course, they have trained up some pilots now that are bombing the Yemenis. But the question is also, what kind of a message does it send to the larger Middle East? And can we really rely on the Saudis as our representative on the sort of the Sunni arc that is supposed to challenge Iran? I think it's a really bad bet. And if we prefer only business deals, if we as transactional as President Trump wants to be,
yeah,
then the consequences might be that once something else explodes in the Middle East and it's about to do so, we may be deeply involved in carrying out the duties that we once expected the Saudis to do for us.
Alan?
Well, there are a couple of things here. First of all, what's happening to the Yemenis is crazy. I mean, this is a terrible, terrible result as these people get bombed and can't eat and can't live and the rest of it, and the Saudis are doing it. So we have this substantive problem, this terrible war that is going on. And so what we hear here is that the real problem is that they don't produce the head of the CIA to testify about it, but not about the war, this terrible war, which our listeners have been writing us mm-hmm. about, you know, for months now and saying, what's going on here? So you have now today, you have United States senators finally giving a little comeuppance to the president for not allowing the CIA director to come and brief them, as opposed to the substantive problem of what's going on in Yemen.
Right. It seemed like the Republican senators were having a hissy fit, a matter of pride that the Haspel didn't show, rather than the substantive mm-hmm. issue of mm-hmm. what's happening in Yemen. That was the surprise yesterday, was the fact that Republicans were standing up. I thought, they've caved on every other issue. Why are they standing up now?
So you get Lindsey Graham, of all people. You know, he's not my favorite. And he gets up there and he says that he's PO'd, a word which we're not supposed to use on the radio.
Well, I mean, yeah. Isn't it, don't you think, Alan, it has to do with the fact that he has been criticized over the Kavanaugh hearing as being overly rabid. You know?
Yes.
I don't know if that's a, you know, he was rabid.
Yeah.
And now he's trying to show, oh, I'm independent. I'm challenging this president after all. You know, I mean, for me, this is part of a performance. I'm surprised Gina Haspel has not spoken out in some way, because clearly the CIA was called an agency that, you know, that President Trump basically said the CIA information is not necessarily believable or reliable. They don't have all the information.
And that information was, it was widely reported in the press, which we have to assume was Haskell speaking, that they were quite sure that that's what happened, that this was a terrible thing, and that we had that they had killed the guy. And what else can I tell you?
You don't carry out any activity in Saudi Arabia unless you have been ordered by the crown prince. You just don't do anything.
Right.
You don't move. You don't breathe in the security services unless the crown prince tells you to do so.
We, I just want to, there's breaking news in that Michael Cohen is expected to plead guilty to misleading Congress about the Russia investigation. This was an unplanned court appearance. He's in federal court in New York, where he is expected to plead guilty to making false statements to Congress about the Russia investigation, and we'll have more on that.
Remind everybody, Joe, who Michael Cohen is.
Michael Cohen was formerly known as the president's, or I should say Donald Trump's, fixer. He was his longtime attorney. He had an office in the same, just a couple doors down from the president of the United States. And the questions that I believe this came out of regarded the payments to Stormy Daniels and fixing that situation where a porn star alleged that she had an affair with the president and then was paid off by the Trump organization.
So for the last several days, we have seen people like major people who pled guilty to crimes and now saying they're not going to sign something that that really isn't true, as if that's the case. So what we're looking at here is a setup. Is Cohen going to do the same thing that we've seen?
Well, I mean, if he's pleading guilty, so what does that mean?
Well, everybody else pled guilty. We saw, you know, we've seen other guys plead guilty, and now they're saying, yeah, you know, but they wanted me to, I'm not going to cooperate with them because they wanted me to sign saying I did something I didn't do.
I don't think Cohen is going to do that because the president has targeted him for being a loser and a traitor to him, and he's not loyal. I think Cohen has no benefit from not cooperating now. I think it's entirely different, is my suspicion.
You know, as Al D'Amato once said, that was then and this is now. You know, these guys change on a dime. So the president certainly changes on a dime, and I think that's going to be what one would suppose would happen with Cohen, who, after all, is a sleazebag.
ABC News is reporting that special counsel Robert Mueller has reached a tentative deal with Michael Cohen, the former personal attorney and longtime fixer for President Trump. Cohen is scheduled to appear in federal court in Manhattan on Thursday, where he is expected to enter a guilty plea for misstatements to Congress and closed-door testimony last year about his contacts with Russia and the Russians during the presidential campaign. Once among the president's most loyal and zealous defenders in business and politics, Cohen has now promised to put family and country first by cooperating with prosecutors, becoming perhaps the most pivotal public witness against his former boss. He has given over 70 hours of interviews to the special counsel.
So he doesn't just plead guilty. He has to, we're going to get some details about exactly how he pleaded guilty. So expect more details as the day unfolds about what exactly he said that was incorrect.
That's right. And so a former U.S. state's attorney in Florida, Kendall Coffey, says it cannot be determined if Cohen's cooperation will lead to other criminal allegations, but for most high-powered business people with complex business interests, having one person's personal attorney become a star witness for the prosecution is the worst possible legal nightmare.
To which I say,
you can't make this stuff up.
You can't.
No, you can't. You and you know what? What just happened?
Up. Yeah.
The Saudi issue is off the agenda.
Yep.
The Yemenis will not be discussed. And this is what is at the front and center now, again, once again. And we'll have to wait till January. I mean, there was a bit of posturing now in the Senate about this Khashoggi situation. And Gina Haspel coming out and demanding that she provide some more information and testimony. But now it's gone.
It's gone.
This is going to linger, and this whole Yemeni situation is just going to be dreadfully horrible in terms of the human rights crisis. And this is what we're talking about now.
Why do you
Cohen,
think,
Stone, all these guys.
Well, you know, I remember talking about this, you know, 30 years ago when I was in school and about why international stories don't rise to the top. I mean, what is the reason for that?
Well, I think this country is a very large country. People are very much domestically focused. And people are also not very, I mean, a lot of Americans never travel. They don't seem to have passports. They don't seem to know much about other countries. The assumption is, I mean, I hear this a lot from my students. They say, well, we never learned about this before.
Right.
We never realized all these things that we do as a nation in foreign policy. We just had no knowledge of that. We never discuss it in schools. And so because 90% of the American public is not aware of what else is going on or how the U.S. behaves internationally and how many military bases, like I think 750 or 800 military bases around the world. We're basically a major, should I say, occupation force in the world.
But it's so short-sighted because... Mm-hmm.
I'm going to hold... Can I hold you right there, Fran? We just have a break to do, and then we'll come back, and then we'll continue this, and we'll get right back to it. Panel at WAMC.org, if you would like to add your thoughts. We'll be right back right after this. Okay, I'll admit I forget exactly what we were talking about before we go to break, but Fran, do you remember?
Yeah. We were just talking about Americans and their knowledge of what's going on internationally, and my not-so-unobvious comment is it's very short-sighted of us because the things that are going on all around the world aren't just happening somewhere else. They're affecting Americans. You know, you think about repression in China. You think about GDPR. I was just in Africa. Mm-hmm. It's an amazing continent with a lot going on in each of the countries. And, you know, I mean, all of those things are affecting us in one way or another. So we can ignore what's going on, but it's not strategic. It's short-sighted. And you know, we live in a global world.
And even if it doesn't affect us, even if children are being killed by U.S. bombs, it's something we as humans need to care about.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing I wanted to say, the United States also looks pretty bad in a number of ways, not only because, you know, Yemenis on the ground find U.S. stamped shell casings and weapons. So they think the U.S., I mean, they know the U.S. is supplying the Saudis with weapons. They find USA stamped on some of the remnants. And it reminds me so much of the early 1980s when the United States supplied, for example, the Salvadoran vicious army with U.S.-made weaponry. And then the Salvadorans used it to wipe out entire villages. I mean, for example, I don't know if anybody remembers the massacre of Almusota, where 900 uninvolved women, children, and elderly and people were just massacred by this supposedly elite battalion that the United States supported. And then Congress talked about, oh, well, it must have been the rebels who did it. Oh, no. It was U.S.-supplied weapons used by the Salvadoran military to massacre its own population. And didn't we learn any lessons from those kinds of incidents? We have people on the border as a consequence now, 30 years later, still the misery of Salvadorans, Central Americans, trying to escape it. And now we're just as deeply enmeshed in this Yemeni debacle and other areas. Do we ever learn?
We have a couple letters on this very subject.
We do, Joe. Thank you. And we heard from Otis, who says, in Beckett, while the Saudis should be excoriated for what they're doing in Yemen, let's not forget the rebels are no choir boys either.
The Houthis are brutal, absolutely. They are also brutal. It's a proxy war between the Iranians and the Saudis, no doubt.
And then we heard from Roger, who says, folks, there are a lot of smart people on the panel. See, guys? Please provide some clarification for me. I thought the Saudis were fighting in Yemen at our request. My understanding was that we did not want to use covert forces in Yemen to push back the Iranian trouble, so we demanded the Saudis take up the fight, which they did. Why are we now condemning the Saudis for doing what we asked? Roger from Warwick.
Yeah, I don't think it was quite our request. I think the Saudis really wanted it. When you look at a map, Yemen is a strategic area for the Saudis, and they have been watching and challenging areas that they feel should be under their control for a long time. So while the U.S. may have endorsed this, I don't think the U.S. was pushing for this particular intervention.
All right, let's move on to some other topics, talks about some other things. We do welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Nancy Pelosi, we have been talking about her off and on over the last 2 weeks. Democrats resoundingly nominated Nancy Pelosi as speaker, but defections signal a fight ahead. This from the New York Times. Representative Nancy Pelosi overwhelmingly won the Democratic nomination on Wednesday, bless you, to be Speaker when the new Congress convenes in January. But the defection of 32 Democrats signaled that she could still face a divisive fight to lead the House just as the party assumes control. The result kept alive the threat of a messy intra-party feud and touched off what promises to be an intense period of internal arm-twisting and cajoling by a leader renowned for both. At the same time, it confirmed that despite a drumbeat of calls within her caucus for new leadership, most Democrats support returning the 78-year-old Californian, the first woman to be Speaker, to that post. Okay, so 203 Democrats are supporting her, 32 no votes. Does that really, how much concern is that? I mean, that just doesn't seem to be that big of a obstacle to overcome to me, but maybe I'm being naive.
Well, you need 218 in order to win. 203 ain't enough. We have seen Nancy Pelosi furiously the last couple of weeks saying, OK, I'll make you the chairman of this committee or that if you come along. She's tough. I mean, she's just one tough lady and she knows what she's doing. I told you a long time ago that she was going to be the speaker. Mm-hmm. And she is.
So it seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but the big problem seems to be in the just looking at the opposition side of those opposing Nancy Pelosi, that they haven't found anybody to run against her. I mean, that seems a major problem of, oh, we need somebody else. And then you ask the obvious question, who? And they're like, we don't know.
And plus, it's not a position that you can just jump into. This is an incredibly technical position. This is not necessarily a position where you interact with voters so much. You have to know all the rules. You have to know all the tricks of the game. This is something you work towards.
But to your point, Alan, earlier in the week when you said a lot of these people are voting for cover. So you can say in the first vote, I voted this way. And then when it comes down to it, you turn around and say, I'm doing the best for the party.
No question. However, I can see where this thing could go south. I'm very interested in what Judy Patrick has to say about this.
Well, I'm saying the sexism continues. You know, there was I love Twitter. Last night on Twitter, some great Twitter guy posted side by side a story from the New York Times when Paul Ryan was nominated as House Speaker compared to the nomination of Nancy Pelosi. Paul Ryan, the vote was 200-43. Nancy Pelosi's vote was what? She was 32 votes short.
Yeah.
The old story about Paul Ryan didn't talk about the arm twisting he was going to have to do.
The cajoling,
iron fisted Nancy Pelosi. You didn't see that with the Paul Ryan. I'm just saying that when women assume leadership positions, it's always you've got to add the sense of drama. You've got to. I find it interesting that the renegade Democrats are arguing for changes in how the House operates. But I don't like the depiction of her as this, the continuation of the Republican demonization of her.
Uh-huh. It's so funny. At least we didn't hear what she was wearing. There's some good news. what was interesting to me is I saw it as there is really a movement among this freshman class of congresspeople for change. And what I thought was interesting is you look at the leadership that got elected, and, you know, half of it mm-hmm. is, and now I'm going to use, you know, bad terms, old white people, right? But half of it are sort of newcomers.
It's not bad, that's true.
Yeah, a bad, well, that'd be true. Men and women, right? But half of them were newcomers, and newcomers mm-hmm. that sort of represent a next generation of leadership. Because if you think about it, you know, we need a trajectory. Mm-hmm. We need a trajectory of leadership from where we are now to where we want to go. And it has to be something that encourages the voters. And so I actually found it kind of encouraging that the outcome, not maybe the reason why people voted, was that you both get this experience, which is critical to get anything done. It's hard to be effective when you don't really know the ropes. But you also get sort of this next generation of leadership. And I think if these folks, you know, all get, you know, in, can work together, I think that's a good sign.
Well, the big if there is if they can all work together. Now, so finally, you do the one thing that was incredibly important in the United States. You get one House of Congress, which is going to get in Trump's face and stop this trajectory towards fascism that we see in the country. So you would think that just for a little while, you know, the Democrats could get together and work this thing so that what they're supposed to be doing, which is looking at Trump and holding him down, would happen. I'm a little bit worried about the traditional circular firing squad that the Democrats are known for forming. It really is frightening, I think.
Well, one of the things that I'm thinking about is I agree with the fact that you can't hold young, newly elected, energetic members to old rules where you just wait your turn. You cannot expect a party to be energized if first-termers simply are told, you learn all the ropes, you wait for 8 or 10 years, and then maybe you can rise to a leadership position. How about a more of a European model where you actually begin to mentor and bring younger people up and have a shadow or co-leader in certain areas?
And if you take Nancy Pelosi for mm-hmm. at her word, that's exactly what she says she wants the next 2 years to be.
Yeah, that's right.
And she needs to do that because she's, I think she's 78 years old, if I remember correctly.
That's not so old.
Well, it might not be, but she may not have another term after this one.
No, that's
and
right.
I agree she will be the elected speaker.
No, yes, but let's try to figure out what could happen here.
So I
you
think
need 218, right?
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't have 218. If the 36 decide that they're going to unify and not let her have it, then that's an opportunity for somebody else to come forward. Right now, we don't have anybody, as you've all mentioned. But that doesn't mean it's not going to happen.
Where are the 36 going to vote for Republicans?
No. But they could say, no, but they could say we're not going to vote for her and stick
with
it,
Judy. Well, they could be blank. They could be leave the vote blank, and that's
right.
That.
And there were some blank votes.
Yeah,
so
there were some
blank votes. What about uh-huh. Seth Moulton? Where does he fit into all this?
Massachusetts?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, he
that's
seems to be the ringleader, right?
I think he's inconsequential.
Yeah,
and
I would agree with that.
And you know the new crop of mm-hmm. Congress people coming into Washington, if they were serious about it, they'd have a candidate. Nobody's stepped forward at all. And in the meantime, nobody's talking about Mitch McConnell being too old. You know, is he going to be elected?
But he's too bad.
but we don't talk about fresh ideas in the Senate.
That's a really good point.
Come on.
Because we also don't talk about it because we have now made the assumption that Republicans don't seem to care about young voters, minority voters. I mean, this is pretty clear. That party is not going to reach out and become the big tent.
You know, I've been covering legislative politics for a long time, watching what happens. And you can't discount the concept in politics of opportunism. Mm-hmm. You know, there are some young guys who say, okay, I got elected, now maybe I could go all the way to the top, and I'm going to cause as much hell as I possibly can without thinking of what I said before about holding Trump responsible. You know, one of the things I think that cost John Faso his office was the idea that, you know, forget about Faso Delgado. Remember, that vote could have been the vote which would turn the House blue. And I always thought that that was what was going to kill Faso, and it did.
You know, in the meantime, the House has to get some things done.
Yeah.
And if people are too dogmatic.
Oh, right.
Yeah. That. You know, it's more than just who's on what committee. It's getting some, if they really want to get legislation passed, they have to work in a way, and they have to learn to compromise. They have to learn to work the system. And then they've got to get it through the Senate and passed signed by the president.
And then they have some people, I think, in the House that will be acting as the ones that challenge Trump all the time, the attack dog, the verbal attack dogs, the kind of, you know, that's their brand. And then there are others that will compromise, and exactly what Judy was talking about, getting something done, because without a legislative agenda, the Democrats will go nowhere.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We have a lot of other topics to discuss. We will do just that. Panel at WAMC.org is how you can reach us. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We have Vera Karius-Kelly, Judy Patrick, Fran Berman, and Alan Chartok, who has letters. So we're going to read a couple.
Yay. All right. Michael writes, Deutsche Bank. They're looking into Deutsche Bank money laundering in Germany concerning Panama companies. Might they just run into some stuff about you-know-who? And it's signed the Turk in Rhinebeck.
Yeah, well, you know, Deutsche Bank is a slimy bank. And yes, they will find a lot of information on a lot of people and maybe also on some special people in leadership in this country.
And Deutsche Bank, right, Vera, has been mentioned several times in the Trump melange.
Absolutely.
Right, those offices were raided by German police today.
Yep. So they've been raided multiple times. I mean, this is like...
They would have gotten it all the first time.
Well, those banks, you know, they are quite good at hiding stuff, I would say.
You got to look in the drawer above the sink. You always have to do that. All right, Alan, go ahead.
Brenda says, Americans, a thought in regard to Americans' knowledge and interest in international affairs. Geography and history play a part. An island hemisphere between two oceans, as well as a pioneer focus on building a country, etc., contribute to our insularity. And that's from Brenda.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many reasons why we apparently, you know, the size, the geography, the sort of, you know, notion of exceptionalism, all of these factors.
I don't buy that entirely, because when I visit with colleagues around the world, Canada's out there. Canada has the same geographic.
Canada is small in comparison to us. So they have a need for more international.
I don't think it's just that we're separated by oceans and on a continent.
Yeah.
But this is
relatively
something
by ourselves.
President Trump is encouraging this. Nationalism. Just us. We don't care about anything beyond our borders.
Yeah, good point.
And a lot of his base think that's a great
idea. But it's always been like this. It's not. Yeah, we have trends, you know, where it improves a little bit. But, you know, in essence, we have always been that way in the United States, you know, very focused on ourselves because of our economic size and
prowess. We expect everyone else to learn English. It's not common in many places for Americans to know other languages. This is crazy.
I'm just waiting for China to really economically challenge the United States and the notion to arrive that maybe the biggest, most important, most influential language in the business world will be Chinese. Hmm. Can you imagine?
Can you imagine?
Can you imagine?
We have an underwriter here on WMC. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you've all heard that underwriter who talked about, you know, a Chinese immersion high school.
Right.
What a good idea.
Yeah.
Why not?
Yeah. Keith writes, 70 hours of testimony. Good morning, panel. 70 hours of grand jury testimony? ? Is that an unprecedented amount of time in front of a grand jury? That's like two full work weeks. There must have been a crime or two dozen revealed. Lock them up. And that's from Keith.
Okay.
All right. Does Putin, to the panel, says Gregory, does Putin sense that Trump's power may be ending soon? Will that tempt him to step up his actions to grab what he can while Trump holds the door open for him? That may be behind what is happening in the Sea of Azov.
Yes, the Ukrainian situation. I mean, it's very tense. And now that I think Trump left this morning for Argentina,
they're going to meet, right? With Putin and China.
One can only hope that President Trump is fully aware of what's going on in the Sea of Azov and mentions to President Putin that this would be a good time not to challenge the Ukrainians any further, and that the United States and the Europeans will back up Ukraine.
Unless, of course, Vera, this president is in the pocket of Putin to begin with, which many people suspect he is, and that he's much more interested in advancing Putin than what goes on here, our interests.
Yeah, well, I personally think that Trump is all about personal gain and personal benefit. So I'm not even sure he's in the pocket of Putin. He just hoped for some amazing business deals.
Unless he's gotten some amazing business deals in the past.
He may have. We may have. I think that's where we probably will find out more information, hopefully through Deutsche Bank and various other places. I'm hopeful that something from the newest fishing expeditions will actually lead to some additional evidence that we could use.
I'm with you.
All right, let's do some other, go to some other stories, and I'm blanking out, but we did the, did we do the last break, Mike? Did we do, okay.
Yeah, we did.
All right.
What did you?
Completely forgot that. Okay. Let's go to, let's talk about Google and Dragonfly as we're talking about China and what's going on there. So we have Google, and Fran Berman, tell us what Dragonfly is.
Oh, this is very interesting. This is Google's name for the project where Google would work with China to provide a browser, and this is in the context of China's policy around censorship. So Google would help with finding things that are uncensored, and they would work with China around censored material. And to me, the really interesting piece of this is you're seeing Google employees not just protest within Google, but now protest publicly about it. And this follows on kind of a recent trajectory where you see big tech and in particular Google employees protesting Google getting into areas where they are not comfortable. So the last time we saw this is something called Project Maven, where Google was going to work with the government on providing better artificial intelligence to target drones, right? So Google employees saw this as a way for them to help the U.S. government kill people better. And they didn't like it. And they protested it, and Google decided not to go for that. So now, with Dragonfly, Google employees are not happy supporting censorship. And they protested. Google has not walked out of that at this point, but they've left the door open. And, you know, to me, the significance of this is these big companies, Google, Facebook, Amazon, Microsoft, Apple, all of these are sort of coming to a watershed moment because employees inside these companies have opinions about what they're working on and what is okay. The U.S. government is assuming that these companies are going to take leadership doing things for the public good, which is not their mission. Their mission is, you know, to make a profit and make money. I mean, they're in the private sector.
So what's the public good?
It's tough.
What's the public good part of it? I mean, in the best case scenario, in the wine and roses section of this, what do we get out of this?
Well, the public good is really important, and this is a part where this is a place where I feel personally really strongly that the government is just not stepping up the way it should. And the government's job is to provide guardrails to keep us safe, to keep us secure, to do things that are not necessarily in the interests of any one company. You know, if you think about this, you know, there are rules about, you know, working. We have child labor laws. We have OSHA. You know, those are things the government can do because they're not necessarily on the profit trajectory. And when you look at the cyber world, there's tons of things that we need. We need better security for devices. We need a better way of coordinating these devices as we sort of move into the Internet of Things. We need more privacy on the consumer end. We need more enforcement on privacy laws in other ends. These are things only government can do.
Are you surprised, Fran, that Google employees have been allowed in quotes, to do this kind of thing and to protest that way? I mean, you're the maven on all of this.
Well, I don't know about the maven, but I think it's interesting because I think it has to do with sort of the culture of tech companies. And tech companies are, you know, oftentimes run by, you know, millennials and above. They're oftentimes come out of the really fascination with the innovation that occurs, but with folks that are, you know, the kids of baby boomers trying to lead, you know, good and ethical and, you know, good lives. They're often organized in a way that employees have a lot of say. Mm. And these are very valuable employees, that, you know, are strong programmers, a lot of advanced degrees, et cetera. And so if you think about this, these are different kinds of companies than the companies that, you know, our parents and our grandparents were part of, where, you know, if you didn't like it, just go work somewhere else.
Or the boss fired you.
Yeah. And so it's sort of interesting to see people sort of rise up and say, mm-hmm. we expect to be doing more about the public good in this company. And of course, that's a conflict for the company.
But so I think it's really interesting when you think about the role of the corporation, right? I think with the 1980s, the role of the corporation with the internationalization, globalization, it really changed because that's when companies became entirely focused on profit margins and stockholders. Before that, companies were often had sort of a consciousness about being part of a community in partnership with employees. And then when the markets internationalized, corporate entities were removed from local communities. In some ways, we see a bit of a merging going on now where younger people are saying, you know, that direction was not helpful to us. We have become disconnected from our own communities, from larger global questions such as human rights, such as environmental destruction, such as surveillance society behavior. And I think this is the moment where we begin to see a pushback against this entire focus on pure profit margins. People are beginning to say, younger people are beginning to say, really, is that who we want to be? Is that a company we want to work for? Or do we expect the company that we work for to actually think about the consequences of what we produce, how we behave, and what policies we endorse?
Yeah, I agree with that. But if you think about this mm-hmm. is a headline society. Mm-hmm. So we are going to start seeing movement on the public sphere when really catastrophic things happen. Mm-hmm. We're going to see it happen as we have when everybody loses their social security number through your credit agency. We're going to see it happen when people die mm-hmm. because your self-driving car gets hacked or because your pacemaker gets hacked or because someone releases some sort of virus that sort of takes down your business.
You can hack a pacemaker?
You can hack a pacemaker.
Damn. All right, we're gonna take a break. And how's your pacemaker, Ray? Doing well? All right, we'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartog is here, Fran Berman, Judy Patrick, and Vericarious Kelly. We are very happy to have you all. Panel at WAMC.org, if you would like to get in on the conversation. We have a couple letters. We'll go to those, and we'll move on to some other stuff. I want to talk about Mars.
All right, Joe. Russ says, birds of a feather. It is difficult to imagine that the man who deliberately traumatized hundreds of children seeking asylum would feel any compunction over pardoning Paul Manafort. The question isn't whether the man is a criminal, but like Joe Arpaio or the Saudi crown prince, whose kind of criminal is he? And that's Russ from Menands. I have no doubt that Russ is right. I think if this guy is cornered to the point where he really has no room to wiggle, he's gonna pardon these guys. Yeah, I think he has no choice.
He will. He will. But, you know, it still doesn't mean that all of them get to walk away from state charges. And, you know, there are other problems for which they can get entangled. So pardon or no pardon, something will probably stick.
Well, you know, the states are sort of pathetic when it comes to this kind of thing. And I have to say, Barbara Underwood, the present acting AG in the state, is superb. Mm-hmm. She's done her job and she's done it well.
Yep.
I can only pray that what comes next in Tish James is going to be as good or nearly as good as Barbara Underwood has been.
You know, and the Manafort plea included the mandatory forfeiture of assets. And so that, that will happen whether or not he gets pardoned. He'll lose the houses. He'll lose the bank accounts.
I'll believe it when I see it. Okay, and then Anne says, international travel. This is the first time I've ever written to this panel. I sincerely appreciate I sincerely appreciate the thoughts of the participants. This morning, I have for the first time felt negatively targeted by a speaker.
Oh!
The discussion about why Americans are isolated and do not travel abroad hurt me. My family and most of the people with whom I grew up do not have the money to travel abroad. I come from a working class family, I guess. My mother lived 99 years, with the exception of her final 5 years when she lived with me. Her entire life was spent in Tennessee. A single parent, she worked hard to provide basic living needs for me and my sister. She sent us both to college. There was no money for domestic travel outside of the trips of her family, much less international travel. She never missed a never had a passport. Please show a little bit more understanding, and thank you, said Anne.
Well, I mean, you know, I agree with that. Not everybody has money to travel, but it is possible, for example, when you do go on a family vacation and you live, for example, in upstate New York, to, if you have a car, drive across the border and go to Canada to camp.
With your passport.
With your passport.
Mm,
I totally get people have no money and don't have time or the resources to go on vacation. What I'm mostly concerned about is people that are representing us in government and make policy choices, and when they don't travel and they don't take any of these issues into consideration, that is a serious issue. In addition to that, you could also, through your education, learn a lot about other countries. Learning foreign languages, looking at a map, looking at the geography of countries, and trying to understand larger issues through your educational experiences.
Well, I want to thank the reader for that letter. I think it's a really important thing to say, and it's a useful perspective. But other than traveling to other countries, there's lots of other ways to get this perspective. One is what you read. You know, I often read The Guardian and other foreign papers because it's really interesting to get their perspective on what we do. The other thing is there's lots of people in our own community that grew up somewhere else. And, you know, especially if you live around a university or if you're in a town where people have come, you know, getting to know them and getting to know their perspective is just really invaluable because, you know, once you sort of step outside your own perspective, you really see things in a new way. So I encourage, you know, I mean, I think economics matters in terms of getting out of the country, but there are other ways we can kind of get our heads out of the country.
Yeah, and when you travel, Fran, of course, you can travel cheap. I'm married to a woman who would, you know, die if she couldn't travel. And on one trip, she didn't have enough money, so she sold her blood.
Oh.
Yeah, she went to the hospital and sold her blood. Oh.
Well, I mean,
that's
That is absolutely true. It was in Greece.
You.
You go into the place, and then they people hold up cards as to what their blood types are. She sold her blood.
Wow, interesting.
How far did that get her?
Well,
got her home.
Athens.
The main point is we can travel now through other ways, through the use of our imagination and mind. We can interact with visitors and either temporary visitors or permanent residents in this country, people from other countries that also contribute to our communities, and we can have those interactions and also learn about the world
and gain other perspectives. Through cyberspace. I mean, it's been fun because when I come on here, I try to tweet about it, and I noticed today, I got a follower from France, right?
Ooh,
where did that come
really?
From?
Yeah.
How interesting. And, you know, and I love that too. And hello, follower from France. I just think there are people all over the world, and it's really important for us to get to know their perspective.
Mm-hmm.
One more?
Thank you this letter, though.
Okay. And Jamie says, Yemen menu. No, Yemen mend. So why can't we airdrop food? The Saudis have complete control of the airwaves over Yemen, and we can see that children are starving to death. I remember we once held concerts and marched to stop such behavior. And if they try to claim the rebels steal the food, then drop more. Drop so much food that everyone gets too fat to fight. It's a better solution than doing nothing.
Well, I mean, the ports are also closed. The ships have not been allowed to enter with the food deliveries. I mean, we have a really substantial crisis. And, you know, we just have to look at the images of those poor, starving children. So it's really repulsive. But, you know.
But, you know, you're not seeing a lot of political leaders talking about this crisis. What you're seeing is you're seeing it in the media. You're not seeing the president talk about this at all or any of the people in Congress. I mean, where is the leadership on this for the citizens of the U.S. to respond to? It's not there.
Yeah, it's got to be somebody who says, let's go.
Well, it's too embarrassing because we've supplied them with weapons. It's our weapons that are being used. It's
maybe they should send Jared Kushner over there to start some peace process.
Well, that is his area of expertise, you know.
Exactly.
All right, let's go on to some other things in the few minutes that we have left. And so let's talk about what happened on Mars this week and the secrets of Mars. What do we know about Mars? NASA's InSight mission has touched down on Mars to study the red planet's deep secrets. Fran, what are the deep secrets of Mars? What are we looking for?
This is really cool. We're ending up with the good news story. This is a great story. The InSight mission, I've been flying for about 6 months. The InSight lander just landed on Mars this week. And what they're going to be doing is kind of looking at, you know, the heart of Mars. They're looking underneath the crust. Mars is a terrestrial planet like Earth and Mercury and Venus. They are going to be listening to the seismic activity on Mars, earthquakes, Marsquakes. They're going to be creating an accurate 3D model. They have heat sensors, and they're going to be looking at whether the core is molten or solid. These are really important geophysics questions and looking at the tectonic activity. And it says a lot about rocky planets just like ours. So once we understand what happens in Mars, that gives us a better understanding about how Earth is created. And it's just a great mission. It will happen for one Martian year, which is roughly two Earth years. And we're really looking forward to getting the results back. People at the Jet Propulsion Lab in California who've been making this happen were thrilled. And it's pretty exciting to see.
And I heard on NPR this morning the other story, which is that we're going to try to land on an asteroid. And that asteroid could be a bad character.
They're going to pogo. They're going to jump off it. They're going to just like pogo stick off the asteroid because it can't actually land.
Really?
Like, graze it.
Is that right?
Oh yeah.
Well, and the
pogo
beauty.
Pogo stick
and the beauty.
Off of it. I love that image.
That's what the scientists last night were.
Oh, really?
They were just going. It's like a pogo stick.
Yep.
And what we heard on NPR this morning, which was unusually important, was that. It was going to be, we were going to be in a situation where that asteroid might hit us someday. So we really ought to know about it in order to get into a proper defensive posture.
Yeah, I mean, all of this information is incredibly important. I mean, you might think, you know, here I am and I'm kind of worried about paying my bills next month. So what do I care about the universe? But it turns out that all of the things that are happening in the universe and, you know, what our planet is made of and how it responds to climate. And, you know, I mean, those all of those things really matter in terms of, you know, the future of the human race. So,
and did they ever have people on Mars? Do we know that?
In the movies, I was delighted
to
see
know.
Jason Bourne on Mars, but no.
Matt Damon.
Sorry. Yeah.
So one of the things I always think about is why don't we spend more money on exploring space, in essence, rather than thinking about a space force? You know, we always militarize everything right away. I think it's so important to actually research what's happening, explore, let the scientists take charge of our agenda rather than go with the imagination of having to somehow figure out how we can use certain asteroids to attack an opponent, for example.
Well, you know, but you know, economic decisions, you know, at the large scale, mm-hmm. sometimes even at the small scale, are often political. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not necessarily based on the science or based on what economists say, or you know, it's political. You know, who will gain, and often who will gain in the short term. So it's not surprising that when you want to bring something to someone's attention, you know, there either has to be some catastrophe or some fear or some, you know, some other thing.
Now, last report, the Trump administration really did want to create this space armed services.
Yes, yes. It's under discussion, and apparently they're now slightly worried that the House will not agree to the funding that has been earmarked for the Space Force.
And on the other hand, we're debating whether or not in our farm bill, kids can have a hot lunch and milk in the SNAP program. So, you know, there are priorities. Every time I say this on the air, somebody writes me a how dare you letter, because I do think that we have to examine our human needs, too, when compared to, you know, what we're doing in terms of our space program.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the other remarkable thing about the space program is how patient the scientists are, because it takes forever to get there, and it's going to take forever to get the results. I mean, I'm from, in my business, we find news, we report it really quickly, but scientists need this incredible patience, because everything seems to take months, if not years, for things to happen, for them to come to a conclusion. Their whole career could be spent just waiting for the results to come back from Mars.
Yeah, but I'm a scientist, and the great thing about being in science is you're always trying to solve a problem that no one knows the answer to, right? And you make a lot of false starts. You know, there's a lot of times the data doesn't really tell you anything. There's a lot of times you're wrong, just like anything else. But at the end of the day, over time and with lots of people, we do make progress and we do understand things better and we can model what's going on and we have good explanations for things. And those things matter. They turn into products that we use every day. They turn into ways we can improve our lives. They turn into
computers,
you know, a bigger understanding of things. Sure. And that's really exciting stuff to do.
Yeah, it reflects the attention span of our society nowadays, which is very short. But it's nice to know there's scientists out there with the patience to wait a few years for something to get solved.
Yeah, my future daughter-in-law is an astrophysicist, and she's worked on the problem of weighing the mass of a galaxy when you're in it. Now, think about how mind-blowing that is. But, you know, it's just completely wonderful.
How do you know when you're done? How does one finish that work?
It's completely wonderful.
That is very, very cool.
Yeah.
Well, let's end there. My thanks to everybody who was here, and a wonderful, wonderful panel today, and my thanks to everybody. Vera Carius-Kelly, thank you so much. Wonderful to see you. Judy Patrick, thank you very much. Fran? You're on again soon, yes?
I am.
Excellent.
I'm on several times this month.
Excellent. We're glad that you're back in this in our corner of the world. Alan, thank you very much. We will be back.
We'll be back after this.